We are in Perek Daled, chapter 4, after taking a break for Shavuos material last week. No, there are more. Right here. Still have one more also, so we did a brief intro to Devorah when we last did Shoftim, and this the story of hers. I gave you the outline on the sheet last time, the outline of the Prakim, Daled and Hey, chapters 4 and 5. But we're going to pretty much do a reboot, I think, of it. The themes that we're going to see are an increase in the decline of the Jews in their relationship with those around them. Things get worse even than they were in the Ehud story that we saw before. The challenge of uniting the tribes, getting everybody on the same page and going out to battle for each other is another big theme here. Devorah will be the first shofet with a visibly religious role, not just rescuer of the Jews, but a religious role specifically. We're also going to see here three models of female protagonist. We're going to see Devorah, Yael, and the mother of Sisera, not all of whom you're going to be rooting for. And we're also going to see in the fifth parak the role of Shira, the role of these poems that are scattered around Tanakh, and how are they any different from the prose sections of Tanakh. So we meet the Knanim, and I think we started on that last time. The Knanim are another one of those nations who could have been Jews, so to speak, in the sense that we saw with Aram, and we saw with Moab how their path, Aram's path, diverged from ours. Aram being the ones who Abram came from and left. And Moab from Lot, and this whole saga of Sodom, the trait of greed that they exemplify. So Canaan is, in a sense, also could have been you, in the sense that they are the original inhabitants of the land that becomes Israel. It's theirs before it's ours. So we need to understand a little bit about who they are. And their story goes back before the time of Abraham. Their story goes back to the original Canaan, who is the son of Ham, who is the son of Noah. And yeah, that we did discuss somewhat. I brought you the sheet again, number one. The psukim from after the Mabul, where the sons of Noah emerge from the boat, and they are Shem, Ham, and Yefes. And Ham is the father of Canaan. As they are already introduced to us, we find out who Canaan is. And one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, why are you mentioning that his son is Canaan? I mean, all of them go on to have children, and all of their children become the ancestors of the nations we know in the rest of Tanakh. You know, the idea of 70 nations comes from the children of Noah and their descendants as they're listed in the Torah. So all of them are important. Vayar Ham avi Canaan ezer vas aviv. Well, Ham, note again, father of Canaan. He's also the father of Cush, Mitzrayim, and Put. Those are the three other kids that he has, but he's the father of Canaan. Sees the erva of his father, erva meaning that which is normally covered. Vayegeid l'shnei achav b'chutz, and he tells his two brothers, Shem and Yefes. Vayikas Noach miyeno, Noach wakes up. I skipped the relevant sections in the middle, but I trust you know the story. Noach wakes up from his wine. Vayeda isa sherasalo b'noach katan. And he sees that which his young son did to him. Now, Ham is not his young son. This we know because we're given the list of the kids elsewhere. And either, it's not entirely clear what the age order is. But Ham is not the, now I'm second guessing myself. We have him appear as Shem, Ham, and Yefes. And then there's another time when the Pasuk says, Achi Yefes HaGadol, regarding Shem. So I take it back. Ham might actually be his youngest son. It might be Yefes or Shem who's the oldest, and Ham really could be the youngest. So I take that back. Even though we normally list him in the middle, which suggests that he's not. But I don't want to rule it out. Vayomer Arur Canaan, and Noach bursts out with, Cursed is Canaan. Eved Avadim Yele Achav, he will be a slave of slaves to his brothers. So the problems in these psukim here are many. Why do we keep stressing Canaan? What's his role within the story. Why do we keep saying Ham, the father of Canaan, did this? Why does Noah curse Canaan?
Why does he get cursed? Ham is one.
Right, Ham is the one who did
it.
And that's exactly where the Medrash takes it. The Medrash assumes that Canaan is actually the catalyst. And Bino HaKatan is a reference to the youngest of Ham's kids, which is Canaan. And so Canaan is the one who starts things off, puts his father to shame. The whole story is really his catalyzation, which is important because it tells us who Canaan is going to be. This is part of that same idea, which goes back to what we did in Yahushua, that the ancestor dictates to a certain extent traits of the descendant. And one can break away. Rus is an example of someone who breaks out of the Moab identity. But the default identity for this race of people is what we've identified here as Canaan's role.
Why wouldn't it have said that? It says, Vayarcham Avi Canaan, right? So where is it saying that Canaan instigated any of this?
Right, so the big question...
We're asking, why does it keep on saying he's the father of Canaan?
I mean, if it was indeed him, why wouldn't it have said Vayar Canaan?
Right.
Maybe he wasn't like bar mitzvah age yet or something, so all of the punishment came to his father, but it was really him who did everything.
Could be.
Age. It's not necessarily birth order.
Young is not.
He's young.
I also never understood that. Isn't the one who covered him, isn't that doing a good thing?
That shame and yet, that's the one who covered him. Ham is not a coverer.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
So what does he do?
So that's the thing. The literal read of the sentences is that Ham finds out what's happened. He sees his father. He tells his two brothers as a way to mock the father. Shem and Yefes walk in facing away from Noah with a blanket to cover him up. That's the straightforward read of the Pesukim. The Medrash there expands that more was done to him and was done to him by Canaan in order to humiliate him. In terms of the question that Ora asked, I think it's a good question. Why doesn't it just say that? If Canaan was the one who saw it, and that would explain the story in the sense of Noah cursing Canaan of all of them, why doesn't it say, and Canaan saw, and he told his father, who turned around and told the two brothers? The only thing I could say is that it would be wordy, but frankly, that doesn't really answer. We get wordy when we need to. I don't know why it wouldn't be said in a more explicit way than that. The other approach may be, because we don't want to absolve Ham of guilt. In other words, to say it's not just Canaan who did this, but Ham has a bad role in this, and we want to emphasize Ham's role. In terms of the age of Canaan at this stage, that actually is its own problem. Because when you list who goes onto the boat, you only list Noah, his wife, his sons, their wives. It doesn't mention any grandchildren.
They were born on the boat.
Well, that's a problem. In of itself, it's a problem, because if they're born on the boat, how old is he when Noah gets off the boat, gets drunk?
Right.
You know, Noah gets off the boat, brings a carbon, Hashem says, I'm not destroying the world again, and then he plants a vineyard. I mean, it may take a little while to get grapes out of the vineyard, but he can't be old at this point, unless he survived the flood, in which case the question is, so why didn't they mention their kids? That's not an end of the world, so to speak. that's not a really big question, meaning it could be that they're not mentioned because they're little kids and they're there with their family and you didn't need to name them when they went on. That's not the end of the world as a question. But I think that to a certain extent, maybe he really is just viewed as part of his father in this regard, although he's old enough that he recognized that something wasn't as it should be with his grandfather and went and told his father. So something was up in that regard.
Or maybe they mentioned him twice because, like, maybe Canaan was everything to Ham. Maybe he was, like, his favorite son. So in the beginning, they mention him that, you know, this is who Ham is and Canaan is everything to him. And then afterwards, they turn it around and say, well, because he was everything to you and you did this, he's the one who's going to be punished.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Just making some things up.
I don't know. Do you have a Voracious with Rashi? I want to take a look there. They won't have Rashi in it. It's Rashi on the phrase Achi Yefes HaGadol, who goes through the age question and who was the youngest. I'm curious now about this Beno HaKatan and whether Beno HaKatan really is a reference to Canaan.
You have to assume that, I mean, I was thinking that Canaan must be a little bit older at least, because otherwise, I mean, if he's a small child or something like that, why would Noah's reaction be so severe as the person?
You know, he has to be old enough, thank you, to take some level of responsibility for what he's done.
Responsibility.
Well,
it's just punishing the father.
Almost punishing the father, saying, just picking one random son.
Not random, the one who's close to him.
Right. But Canaan did it. He was cursed. He was mentioned. I don't know.
Maybe
because I find that very interesting all the time where they try to confuse us. So when they're trying to confuse us, you know, like if they just said everything straight out, it would be easy to understand. I never understand why they would explain things this way.
Yeah, maybe it'd be that he made it such a bad thing he did. Maybe they didn't want
to. Still don't understand that. Say that.
Yeah, no, Chan is the youngest. So Achi Yefes HaGadol. Sorry. So. But Noah Katan could really be Cham. It's still ambiguous. However we read this story, the traits that are seen in the story are traits that emerge in Canaan down the line. When we say Canaan, we're referring not only to the tribe Canaan, but the Canaani. All those sub-tribes will be identified as Canaani when the Jews enter the land. So, for example, the Emori, right? Hashem has at Bris Ben Absarim, Hashem tells Abraham, your children are going to be slaves and so on, then they're going to come back, but not till the fourth generation, because the sin of the Emori is not yet complete. The Amori are the residents of the land. I'm going to want to kick them out, but I have to give them more time because they haven't been given enough time yet. Ultimately, they're going to. I'm going to be fed up with them, and at that point, I'm going to kick them out of the land. Remember that Abraham says to Eliezer, "I don't want you to get a wife for my son from." Benos Canaan, right? He tells Eliezer, don't get a wife from Benos Canaan, and then Rivka says as well. Granted, Rivka has other motivations for sending Yaakov away, right? Get him away from his brother, wants to kill him. That was important too. Nonetheless, she says, "Kasti b'chayim ibnei Benos Chais." I am disgusted with the daughters of Chait, and we know about Esav's wives that they are, you know, part of that picture. Ephron Hachiti. Right? Chiti being, again, one of these tribes, is the one who plays the game with Abraham, with Maaret HaMachpelah, with the cave to bury Sarah. Not to mention, of course, you know, Dinah and Shechem, and the whole story of the city's response, or non-response, really, when the event takes place. They are depicted, in general, as immoral people, and as people who God despises. I brought you on the sheet in source number 3. The speech that Moshe gives the Jews as they're going to enter Israel, and he says, "You should know, lo v'tzid kascha v'yorsha l'bacha tabal reshes es artzam. You're not getting this land because you are such wonderful people, Jews. Rather, kibirish as hagayim ha'ele, because of the wickedness of these nations, that's why Hashem is taking them away. You are God's tool to eliminate Canaan. That's why you're there. So that." No, it's not
the
best
of the worst, so you get it. Like,
they've lived with Moshe for 40 years in the Midbar. They know who they are.
Yeah.
They know exactly who they've been.
It doesn't really make you want to take it with a whole heart, right? Like, the whole promise that it's about halal advash, you mean promises land, but it's really not for you because you deserve it.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that you also find, I promised it to your ancestors, right, and therefore I have to give it to you, which
and
is also not
and
great.
And go fight for it. So it's like, well, right?
Well, it's go fight for it because this is your shot. This is what you're getting.
It's not really motivating.
Right. No, that's true. On the other hand, as we said when we discussed this passage before, it explains a lot in terms of the whole ethnic cleansing issue. It's not, I want Jews to have a land, so I'm going to take a land that has a population in it, wipe the slate clean, and plant the Jews there. Rather, it's these people had this land. They had this land for generations. They created such a horrible society that I want nothing to do with them, and I don't want them there anymore. And I'm bringing you in order to get rid of what's there. They can make peace. They can dissolve their society and live under you. Or they can fight if they want. But I don't want them there, you know, dominating my land anymore.
God promised it to Abraham before they were so wicked. I mean,
but it's not. He said to Abraham, they just haven't reached the end yet. That doesn't mean that they're wonderful. That just means that they're not as bad as they will eventually be.
I see. Because he promised the land way earlier on.
Right, but what he said then was Lo Shalem Avona Amori Ad Hena, right? The Amori sin isn't complete yet. When you say yet like that, you know, it's just, you know, God's looking at his watch, you know, and thinking to himself, well, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later.
So they were bad from day one. Like, Canaan was bad. All the descendants were bad. They were all bad.
That's the message.
Moab, right? What about Ham's other
Moab
kids?
Moab is the other one.
But yeah, but I'm saying all the other nations were all bad.
Sorry.
What about Ham's other kids? Did they not get the same characteristics?
So that's part of the question of maybe that's why I mentioned Ham, if it's really Canaan who was the agent. We know that none of them are friends of ours. Mm-hmm. Cush is his first one, that's Ethiopia. Mitzrayim is Egypt. Good luck. And then Put, which is mentioned often, Put and Libya are two that are sort of northern Africa. None of them in Tanakh are allies of ours or good.
It's also interesting, the whole concept, I know we're going off on a tangent here, but the 70 nations all come from, wouldn't you think if your parents have kids, you kind of think they're going to stick together. Now, let's have some kids and everybody go fend for yourself and become your own nation. You would think that they would stay together as a family.
You're such a Trentonian.
She's not that.
She's not a Trentonian.
But she is now.
I'm not a Canadian. I don't know. Whatever. Don't you think? Isn't that weird? It's not family mentality to...
So I would say two things. It's an interesting point. I think I would say two things. One is they have the globe at their disposal. Like they have a planet. They have a planet at their disposal, which I think may fail.
Yeah, they totally have no idea what it is.
Right. The bigger.
You want to go on your own? I'm just gonna leave all of you and just go up with my own life. It's so weird.
That one life.
And then anyways. She's got to populate the planet. I think the other aspect of it is the imperative of fill the world, and I think God moves to support having them spread out. The story of Migdal Babel is the perfect example. This whole Tower of Babel story is very, very strange. They say, let's build a tower, its top is going to be in the heavens, and we'll make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the earth. From this, the Medrash looks at it and says, they wanted to fight a war against God. Right? Either they want to prevent God from punishing them with a flood in the future, or they think that they're going to do battle with God, and they reap. You know, the Medrash sees it in various references in the Psukim, but the Medrash is a problem. And the problem is, why is it that until now, when people have done bad things, the punishment has been death? Right? The Adam and Chava become mortal. Cain, we think, is going to die, but then he pleads with God, and then he's told, okay, you have to scatter. You have to wander, and you'll never have a place to be safe, and ultimately, Cain is going to get killed. And then you have the generation of the flood. Obviously, they get wiped out. And here, with Migdal Babel, God says, yeah, I'm not going to kill them. I'm just going to destroy their building and let them, scatter. Maybe make it harder for them to communicate with each other. You know, what happened? Why are they, in fact, allowed to survive? So the classic answer, which the Gemara gives, is that it's because being being against God, but being united yourselves, is something that God values. The fact that they get along with each other is valuable, and therefore God says, I'm not going to kill them. Right? That's you pick that up, early on when you read Midrashim on the story, is that they all liked each other, as opposed to the flood, where they're all at each other's throats, and God therefore says, I'm gonna wipe them out. Here they all get along. Why does that explanation? What's the big hole in that explanation?
That he scatters them.
Yeah, if what you value about them is their unity, why did you decide to scatter them? And that makes no sense whatsoever. But you didn't learn that in school. It doesn't fit at all. So Ibn Ezra has an entirely different take on the story. Ibn Ezra says there's nothing wrong with those people. There's nothing bad about who they are, wanting to build a tower and so forth. What's wrong is that God said, fill the land. And here they are bringing everybody together. And so God says, I'm not going to hurt them, but I don't want them doing this. I want them to fill the land. And therefore he scatters them, and that answers your question, Hoda, is that they don't scatter because they want to. They scatter because God makes them. So that would be how you end up with all of them going off in their different directions. So, but don't worry about a tangent. Yeah. So take a look also at number 4, where Hashem tells the Jews, there are two nations I don't want you to emulate. Kemaasei Eretz Mitzrayim asher yishavtem ba lo sa'asu, do not act as Egypt did. And Uchmaasei Eretz Kenan asher anemi mevi eschem shama lo sa'asu, and don't do the deeds of the land of Canaan. Those are the two who God singles out as people he does not want you to emulate. Now, obviously there's a reason to single those two out. Egypt is where you came from, so you're familiar with them. Canaan is where you're going, and you're going to learn their ways. That's why they need to be singled out. But we are told specifically about how bad they are, and it continues in Yericho with the story of Rachav. Those who were here when we did Rachav's story, you'll remember that. And they attack us when we're in the Midbar. The Canaanim leave Canaan to attack us in the Midbar. It happens after the Meraglim, and then it happens again after Aharon dies. I brought it references in number 5. Canaan is the opposite of the Jews in terms of cultural degeneration. That's really the way that we look at them. Number 7, I brought you a medrash in the Sifri. No, number 6, sorry, we're not ready for the Sifri yet. The Sifra, which is medrash to Sefer Vayikra, also known as Taras Kohanim, says, how do you know that no nation made their ways more to'eva than the Canaanites? I didn't translate to'eva because there is no good English translation for the word, so I just left it as it is. People translate it as abomination, abhorrence, something that God really doesn't like. But the Canaanites are the exemplars of it, because in the section where the Torah speaks of sins and brands them as to'eva, the Torah says, don't be like Canaan. So the Medrash is telling us, like, they're the ultimate in degeneracy. And when we descend and become like them, then they go on the attack. That's what happens in our story. So in terms of who the Canaanim are, we know a little bit now about what they represent. They represent what the Jews were supposed to replace. What we were supposed to get rid of in this land, that's who they are. Now we shift to the other side. Who is Devorah? So we have a lot more than we're going to say about Devorah right now, because a lot of it emerges in the course of Perek Dalet, Perek Hey. But for now, we know that Devorah is going to be described as a Nevi'ah, as a prophetess. That's how she's going to be introduced to us. We'll get to the map on the other side. The other Shoftim we've seen so far have Ruach HaKodesh. Right, that's what we talked about with Vatihi Alav Ruach Hashem. The Spirit of God was upon other Shoftim. Devorah is actually a full blown prophet. We don't know anything about her family. Zero. She will be identified in the opening pasuk as Eshet Lapidot, but as we're going to see, we have no idea what those two words mean. It could mean she's the wife of somebody named Lapidot, who we just don't know anything about and we'll never meet again in Tanakh. But there are other explanations also for it that may be stronger than that. She has no family in the story. And the reason why that's such an important point is not just because we know family of so many people in Tanakh, who are introduced to us, we're told their shevet, we're told where they live, you know. We actually know a little bit about where she lived, that we do have. But it's also important because it's exceedingly rare in Tanakh to be introduced to a woman who is not daughter of somebody, mother of somebody, or wife of somebody. You know? Even when they are women who are clear protagonists in the story, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, Benot Slavchad, and so on, well, they're powerful figures. Not, you know, they're not being dismissed. Nonetheless, they're also defined by their relationships with others.
Was the Al have a family?
Yes. We will know her husband, Chever HaKedi. With Devorah, she's just there. That's it. We know nothing to speak of about her parents and so on. And that's a very important point, I think, when it comes to looking at her and what she does. She is also a judge. Literally, the pasuk will say, she judged Israel at that time. And that creates a question which we have to at least address somewhat, because of the little issue of halacha. Right? In general, halacha says that witnesses and judges are male. So how does Devorah serve as a judge? Well, I asked the question, so I don't have the answer.
Do the judges like they have to be male?
Yes. Take a look, please, at source number 7.
Maybe the things that she judged.
Take a look at number 7, the Medrash on Sefer Devarim. The Pasuk says, Som tasim alecha melech, you shall place a king upon yourself. So the Medrash says, Som tasim, meaning, meis minei acher tachlev. If he dies, appoint another one in his place. In other words, it's not going to be a one-shot deal, because the original section, the first verse in that section says, when you want a king, so then you'll place a king. Then place a king, but it's saying it's not going to be a one-shot deal. Once you create a monarchy, the monarchy has to continue. Melech, it says, velo malka. So the Medrash says, not a queen, and then it continues further along in the Medrash to say, ve'ein memanan ha'isha parneset al hatzibur, that you don't appoint a woman as parnas over the community. The position of parnas means a person who is in authority. And this is quoted as halacha in the Rambam. Like, it's not just a medrash that is a voice that gets overruled. It seems like it's actually halacha. Whether people like it or not, accept the reasoning for it or not, is beside the point, because I don't want to discuss the reasoning for it. So that was actually a question that was asked, the question of Golda Meir and her role. Sorry. No, that question was actually asked. Ramosha Feinstein wrote a tshuva. Someone asked him about a woman serving as a mashkicha, whether that would be acceptable. And Ramosha wrote a tshuva saying, yes, she can be a mashkicha. And one of the questions that he addressed and dismissed was the question of, well, a mashkicha, in order to be a good mashkicha, to be a proper kosher supervisor, you have to have the ability to give orders, to say, no, you may not use that, and if need be, to close down production. So she's being put in a position of power over the over the agency, and Ramosha said, yeah, that's okay, that's not a problem. So someone wrote to him and said, if you write that, that's opening the door for Israel to appoint a woman as prime minister. To which he wrote back and said, nobody asked me. the question was debated. It wasn't. It wasn't a simple point for people at the time, the question of of having her appointed. The question is, what do you do here? It doesn't have to be a halachic authority. The point is authority. The point is power altogether.
What about all the yod stuff halacha today?
So that doesn't really pose a swara problem, because it's not a position of authority in any sense. I mean, if a person wants to go to them and ask them to give them what the halacha says, that's not the same problem.
Being presidents of shuls, all these things, all different things. I went to shiur about this. Schools are different than shuls, because you don't have to be on the bima, you don't have to be alone with the rabbi.
No, well, I think it's power. If it's power, then
there are distinctions, but the rabbi the president of a shul is still a big thing. I don't know if you were at that Champions Gate with me, they had a whole session learning about it. The answer was no, by the way, at the end. Yeah.
Really? A woman cannot be.
No, but we've had, Shar Shimon has had that. We've had different pieces.
The issue is discussed, and there are several different halachic answers that are given to the question, including yes and no and in the middle.
Right.
You'll be shocked to know. But my question isn't even, about reasons and what it should apply to, shouldn't apply to. It seems very clear that a dayan, a shofet, is a male. For whatever the reason is. So, how does she end up in this position? So the Radbaz, commenting on the Rambam, on this topic, offers two answers. I didn't bring the Radbaz in the end on the sheet. But it's Hilchos Malachim Perek Aleph Halacha Hey, for those who want to go look it up. One answer, he says, is God said so. you know, God made her the Nevi'ah. He said she's going to judge, and if you have a problem, take it up with God. We'll see what she says. But that was
that was
one answer from the Radbaz, is that God put Devorah in charge.
But who
would have informed them of it?
Yeah,
Devorah. As the Nevi'ah,
that she had already had.
I'm here.
Yes,
I think even more than being a woman, although they're together, is that she came out of nowhere. Like other times, you talk about someone and they have credibility because of their family or because of whatever. She comes out of nowhere and she's saying, bringing the word of God. Well, she could have been fake, right?
Right, but that's true with all the Shoftim. We're not given backstory for any of them. Shamgar ben Anath, here he is. He's gone. Ehud ben Gera, here he is. Story gone. We don't know anything about how they built up to this position at all. But in terms of a Navi, it is an important question in general. How do you know that you can trust a Navi? Particularly because Navim have the power that's called Haras Shah. It was in Toronto Torah a couple of weeks ago. There was a column on the issue. The Eliyahu, at the time of his big showdown with the Nevi'ei HaBaal on Har HaKarmel, is breaking halakha. The halakha is you're not allowed to bring a carbon outside the Beis HaMikdash. There is a Beis HaMikdash in Eliyahu's day. And he brings a carbon on Mount Carmel instead. Why? How? Haras Shah, that was, he knew from God that he should do it. How do the people know that they should follow him? Because he's Eliyahu, he has a track record of righteousness, and he's saying, do this now, but it's a one-shot. I'm not changing the laws of the Torah, which is a very big point that the Rambam stresses, that it's a one-shot. So she says, according to what Rabaz is suggesting, that she says, God has said right now, this is what the nation needs, they need me to be the shofet, and they clearly they follow her. That's one answer. A second answer that Rabaz offers, maybe because he's not so comfortable with the first answer, is that to be shofet doesn't necessarily mean to judge. It could mean teacher of laws. It doesn't have to mean to judge. The problem with that is that that's not the way we usually read it. We usually read shofet to mean shofet. So Ramban offers another answer which has a lot of halachic basis for it. I wrote it for you in number 8. He says, when it says she judged Israel, perusho manheget, it means that she was a ruler. Shalpia ubaat sasasa, you know again zemze kitin malka. She acted like a queen. Based on her word and her counsel, that was what they did.
If you seek it out, it's okay, but if you demand it on someone, it's not.
Well, we're going to get there, actually. He didn't quite say that yet, but that's where he's going. But his first answer is that she's not a judge. She's a queen. Which, that could be an upgrade, right? But he says, V'afa gav damrinan v'sifri, som tasim alacha melech v'lo malka, granted that the same medrash we just read in number 7 said, king, not queen. No again hayuba kidin malka. Doesn't mean she was a queen, but it means that that's the way they treated her. They listened to what she had to say. But then he adds another idea. Inami, alternatively, they accepted her words willingly, meaning the Gemara Sanhedrin says that there are certain qualifications to serve as a judge. Not everybody can, having a Y chromosome is only the start. So the statement, though, that the Gemara makes is that if you have two people who have a case and they decide they want to go to somebody who's not qualified as a judge, that person is going to be the one who's going to hear our case. They're licensed to do so. Nothing obligates you to only go to judges who are appointed as judges. You go to somebody else, you accept that person's word is now binding upon you. And so what Ramban says, it could be just popular acclaim. Yeah, it could be. Shofet really is not a female. However, if the nation says she is the most qualified person out there and we want to follow her, then the answer is okay. And then she becomes a
shofet.
Well, if she's an Nevi'ah,
people use her in that regard.
I mean, she's an Nevi'ah by God. God makes her into a prophet, and I think that sets her up for the nation to accept her.
Right.
They look around and they say, right now we're living under the Canaanim. We've been terrible. We've strayed from God. We would like to come back. Who are you going to ask to lead us? Well, how about this person God speaks to? Oh, that sounds like a good idea. I think that's more or less the way the conversation goes.
Right. But if the Shofet title came from God, we'd be having problems with it.
No, it would. I mean, if God said it, also it would be good. He's giving a different answer. He's saying it isn't necessarily God giving her a title of Shofet, which was, you know, Radbaz's initial answer. He's saying even without that, the nation can choose to accept whoever they choose to accept. And this is broad.
Yeah, but we're saying that we can't have it.
Right, but the answer is no, you can.
That's the other answer that I believe.
Well, it's saying that you can accept. In other words, what he's saying is when the Medrash tells us, you know, that she can't serve in this capacity, don't think of it in terms of today's society. I think that's part of why this is confusing. Today, what does it mean for someone to be a judge if we don't accept them? Right? We appoint our judges. But what the Medrash is envisioning is the way society worked for most of human history, which is a person is a lord over a certain property and says, this person is going to be the one who's going to appoint, I'm going to appoint this judge, you know, for all issues. And if you have an issue, you have a problem, you have to go to them. And what it's saying is he can't appoint a woman as judge, forcing that on the community. But if society says this is our, you know, this
so from the other way, you're saying,
yeah,
but people can appoint who they want or who can listen to who they want,
right? So it appears.
That means any bad leader, as long as they have followers, they're a leader.
Yeah,
well, I wouldn't go from judge to leader like that, because leader is not a formal position in the way the judge is. Meaning,
even works.
Right, but I'm saying that they won't necessarily empower somebody to be a leader in that sense. But I will say, in practice, that's the way human beings work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they're Nazi Germany.
Right, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no halachic significance to the position.
The leader is following the leader. The leader.
Right. So that's the that's Ramban's approach to the problem, and yes, this will then affect any situation in which you have democratic elections. The same argument is going to be made. We accepted this person, therefore they have the standing. There's more to say, as always. I'll leave it at that, ducking the rest of it. So, Canaan, on the one hand, cultural degeneracy. Devorah, Nevi'ah, strong independent figure without any apparent ties to anybody supporting her, but she's accepted by the population, and she's going to judge. Last piece of introduction is our relationship with Canaan. What is the tie between the Jews and Canaan? So if you remember when we read the beginning of the Sefer, we said that the Jews in the center of the country control the mountains, but the lowlands are under the control of the Canaan, and they're the ones who have the chariots. So the Jews are driven up into the mountains. If you take a look now on the flip side of the sheet, the map, so I see it didn't actually come out the way I wanted it to. The shading doesn't really work. This is a Google map of what is today Emek Yisrael. Emek Yisrael, in the original, in their days, was actually bigger than Emek Yisrael is here, at least according to Dat Mikra. But if you see the map, you look at the center of it, there's an area that has a border around it. Afula is right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. For those who were there for Rabbi Yitzchak Shalom's talk, and when he mentioned Afula, he said, nobody knows where Afula is. Everyone here now knows where Afula is. And it's right there in the middle. So so that area that has Afula in the middle of it, now you see the boundary around it? Okay, that is today's Emek Yisrael. What we're going to see in Devorah's story is that that's the stronghold of the Canaanim. And it's right in, if you, you know, look at where things are positioned, it's the middle of the country. Right? Just south of the latitude of the bottom of the Kinneret in the east, of Haifa in the west. I mean, it's well north of Yerushalayim. But it's really center of the inhabited country, and that is their stronghold. Their stronghold. Dat Mikra says that in the days of the Shoftim, it actually ran from the bottom of the Kinneret all the way to the Mediterranean. So it was a much wider, I don't know what their basis is, but it's a much wider thing. At the western end of it is something that's not marked on the map. It's called Charoshet Hagoyim. Charoshet Hagoyim, we'll have to translate it in a moment, but that's where King Yavin of Canaan lives. So what this means for our purposes is that if you're a Jew living anywhere in the northern half of Israel, for sure, and even towards the southern half, and that boundary around what's identified here as the West Bank doesn't exist. So, you know, wherever you are there, you are under the thumb of Canaan. Okay. So, take a look now in Perek Daleth, please. Let's open the Perek. Surprise! Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael asos hara b'nei Hashem. The Jews continue to do that which is bad in God's eyes. V'ehud mate. And Ehud was dead. There's a problem in this sentence. Sorry?
The sentence over here. So.
What do you mean?
Like, doesn't it say, and they continue to do it with him, and after he died, or before?
Right.
Before he died, or
is that question? Right. So Dan Mikra reads Ehud mate means Ehud was dead. However, it could also mean Ehud died, meaning that they were bad before. And if you take a look at source number 10 on your sheet, that's the way that Malbim as well as Mitzudat David take it. They continued to do evil. That was still while Ehud was alive. As long as he was alive, his merit protected them. Which is why it doesn't say, as I said earlier, Vayamat Osniel, Vayosiful Asos Hara, with Othniel Ben Kenaz, the first Shofet, it said he died, and they continued to do bad. Here, the order is reversed. Because here they did it while he was alive. So Ehud mate doesn't mean Ehud was dead, but rather, and Ehud died. So while he was still alive, they were still bad. That was one question within the sentence. The other question is one that we dealt with a couple of weeks ago when we learned about Shamgar, which is, you weren't here, it's not even your test.
Was he before or after? Was he during Ehud, or was he during Yavin's time?
Well, it seems clear that he should be after Ehud, because we read Ehud's story, right? And then it ended in Perek Gimel Pasuk Lamed, I think, it was sentence 30, right? The land was out 80 years. And Ve'acharav, right? You can't get much clearer than the word Acharav. After him was Shamgar Ben-Anat. So, well, if Shamgar Ben-Anat is after Ehud, then why are you mentioning Ehud's death? It should be Shamgar's death. So this is a bit of a problem. So we already saw Ralbag on this point, and Ralbag seemed to be saying that Shamgar was after the Canaanite oppression began. In other words, Ehud died, the Jews went into decline, the Canaanim start to control them, and then Shamgar rises, he manages to kill, as we saw at the end of the previous parak, 600 Plishtim, which, you know, 600 more Plishtim than I've killed, but it means something, but it doesn't save the Jews from Canaan, which is a much bigger force than what the Plishtim are at that stage. So Shamgar rises, but he doesn't manage to actually free the Jews from their enemies. And that would be one possibility. Especially if you envision the way the Shoftim worked as not being national leaders, as Abarbanel thought, but rather you view them as controlling various regions and areas. So Ehud was in one area, Shamgar was in another area. Especially if Shamgar is fighting the Plishtim. Remember, Ehud fights Moab. Moab is off to the east. The Plishtim are west. So it's entirely possible, if you make that argument, that Ehud and Shamgar are really in different spaces altogether, and the Canaanim are north and central and could well be rising even as Shamgar is fighting Plishtim along the coast.
So why say V'acharav?
Right, so that's my problem, is the V'acharav. Then I'm not sure how to fit the V'acharav into it. That's my weakness on this.
And also, wasn't the explanation that Shamgar was only around for like a year and then he died, but we don't see that he died, and then we see later that
Right, the question is whether we accept that view that he only reigned for a year. That was Josephus, which Abarbanel quoted, but we didn't have any other source, you know, for the idea. Take a look at Radak in number 11, please. His approach sounds like what I was saying Ralbag believes. that the Canaanite oppression begins and then Shamgar rises. It appears, he says, that in the days of Shamgar we were not fully saved. He didn't stop them from doing that which was evil in God's eyes. The land was not quiet in his days. Because all the Pasuk said was, he also rescued Israel. Right? We didn't get this big dramatic story. We didn't get any major state. He also rescued Israel. It means he helped them. He drove back some Plishtim. But ultimately, that was it. And so that would be one way to solve this problem. The Jews, Ela dies. The Jews have already started to backslide in Ela's lifetime. After Ela dies, it just gets worse. The Canaanim are in control. And the and Shamgar rises, and whether it's a year or longer, we don't know. But I would also answer the question, which spurred the one-year idea. Meaning the reason why Josephus says 1 year is because the Pasuk doesn't say how long he reigned. So if the answer is because it was absorbed within the Canaanite years, there's really no reason to mention how long he reigned. It didn't affect anything. We know the chronology without that because we know how many years they're under the Canaanite. So that would also, address that question. Okay, so what happens? We know this story. There's that verb again. God sells them to Yavin, king of Canaan, who had reigned in Chazor. So this goes back to a question Alina asked back in Yahushua. Well, that was our problem. Well, you said maybe not. But we'll get to the question and the answer. But suffice it to say, this isn't a new story for us. Yavin had reigned in Chazor. Besar Tzivao Sisera, his general is Sisera, who we'll see a lot of in this parak. V'hu yoshev b'charoshet hagoyim, and he dwelt in this place called Charoshet Hagoyim. So, a few notes here. First of all, Malbim notes this is a new decline for us. This is worse than what's been before. Take a look at number 12, please. Malbim writes, Tchila hayu biyad Aram ubiyad Moab. Initially, they were in the hands of Aram and Moab, the ones from the east. Shalayim and Azayinumos, those weren't from the seven nations of the land who God had said, they're so terrible, you have to get rid of them, and so forth. Ve'ata mecharam biyad melech Canaan. Now he sold them into the hands of the king of Canaan. Ve'nizgayim mashakasu v'hayu lachem litzivim, fulfilling the warning they received earlier in the book, as well as in Devarim, as well as in Yehoshua, that if you leave the Canaanim around, they will be thorns in your sides. That's exactly the what happens here. So it's a new decline. Now you're falling not just to anybody, but to those Canaanim, who you left alive, and, as Carney had said a few weeks ago, who you came to resemble. So who is Yavin? Well, in order to know Yavin is, you have to go back to Yehoshua Perek Yud Aleph, the 11th chapter in Yehoshua. If you, you don't literally have to, although you can. I mean, actually, you know what? Why not? Go back to Yehoshua Perek Yud Aleph. Such a docile class. The story of Yehoshua Yud Aleph has to be viewed in context. So remember that the Jews fight Yericho, they defeat Yericho. They go to war against Ai, thinking they're going to take Ai easily. They're driven back, routed in fact, from Ai. They find out that Achan took from the spoils. They go to war again with Ai after correcting the wrong of what Achan had done, and they defeat Ai. A nation then comes to them, I think it's in Parakhet, and says, we are from far away, and we want to make a deal with you. We would like to have a peace deal with you. We're not of these evil Canaanites in the area. We're the Givonim. And Yehoshua buys their story. There's a whole charade that they put on. They have worn out clothing, and food looks terrible. It's old and stale and so forth, although it doesn't stop the Jews from having a feast with them and eating up their food. Go figure. But the Jews, in the end, make a treaty with them in Parakhet in chapter 8. Then they find out that these Givonim are actually the Chivi. They live next door. They're one of the Canaanite tribes. And they're angry at Yehoshua. And Yehoshua says, look, we made a deal. We swore by God. We have to keep our deal. And the deal is, they get to stay alive. However, they're going to be subjugated to us. They'll be our wood choppers and water drawers for the Beis Hamikdash. They're not going to be equals. That's his compromise. Next Perek, Perek Tes, a whole consortium of nations attack Givon, because Givon has made peace with the Jews. The Jews go to war to defend Givon. That's the whole story with the sun stopping and everything else. And the Jews defend them. And then you get, that's Perek Yud, and then you get Perek Yud Aleph. And in Perek Yud Aleph, we find a king rallying the nations against the Jews. And that king is, at the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph, Yavin. Yavin, king of Chazor. Now, if you look at Perek Pasuk Yud, Pasuk Yud Aleph, in that Perek, what do you find happens to him? Sorry? What is it saying? Right. They conquer Chazor, and they strike its king by the sword. So, what is he doing here now? Chazor, I understand that you mentioned he reigned in Chazor in the past, because Chazor was a great city. When you look at non-biblical sources from that era, Chazor is mentioned. It was apparently a very big center in the region. So I understand why you say who reigned in Chazor, past tense. But what is Yavin doing here? Yavin's dead.
I also listened to Perek Yud, you know, when they listed all the kings. Remember that?
Yeah. The ones who were conquered, yeah.
Mel
Chazor Echad, yeah. So Alina wanted to suggest maybe Hikad doesn't mean kill.
Oh, I thought maybe also like he's like Haro, like Yavin's like a name like...
Right, and that's Radak's approach. Radak's approach is to say that maybe it's a hereditary title, and that makes sense. The word Yavin, it means one who understands, right? So, you know, it's the wisdom of the king, you know, and that's better than naming your king the hereditary title of, like, you know, Eglon, right, the calf. whoever is the king, his new name is Yavin.
Or they just give the kids the same, you know, like George.
Right, yeah. Yavin the first, Yavin Junior, right. But Mitzudat David and Abar Benel actually say that it's the same king. And as for Hikam Beharev, struck by the sword, they say it means the city. It means the city, not the king. They destroyed Chazor, but that Yavin is still alive. Because it is difficult to say it's a new person with that title, because it says, Asher Malach b'chatzor, b'chatzor. It says he reigned in Chazor. So imagine this now. Think this through. That means that the story with Yehoshua and the whole war against Chazor and so forth occurred sometime in the Jews' first 7 years that they were in the land. We don't know when exactly within the seven. Let's say it's year five, just to, you know, throw out a number. That means that you had, after that, 23 years that Yavin has been waiting for this. And then you had the decades of the previous Shoftim, right? Because we had a land being decided and so on. I don't remember how many years we're at now, but it's a while.
It's a while.
We
had 80 years of
quiet. Yeah, but the Shkodar Shmonim Shana. So he has to be fairly old. He's got to be in the middle of his second century by now, if it's really the same person. Yeah. Which, you know, can happen. Moisturizer and stuff. It depends on which one you take within this. But it would be fantastic. You think about it, waiting for a venge that long. You know, and now he finally has it.
Did they mention Sisera in Yehoshua or no?
No generals in that story. Just kings. So, whoever this is, old king, really old king, or, you know, new king, he is living in a place called Charoshet HaGoyim. So that's a hard one to translate. The word Charoshet itself can mean craftsmanship. The Uvacharoshet Evan Lemalot Uvacharoshet Eitz, when they create the Mishkan, Charoshet just means craftsmanship, in which case it means craftsmanship of the nations, or it was a city called Charoshet of the nations. Either way, I have a problem, because it's not of the nations, it's of Yavin Melech Canaan. So Dan Mikra says...
Craftsmanship of a coffin? Maybe he's not really alive?
Ah. That would be weird. Don Mikva points out that in the war of the four kings and the five kings in Abraham's day, one of the kings was Tidal Melech Goyim. So maybe there was a nation called Goyim. It was, you know, because they were descendants of different tribes or something, and maybe that would be one answer. Radak El Ravag say that Charoshet means forest, which we do find. Charash and Charoshet used as a translation for forest from Yar. Sorry? Yeah, interesting, but I haven't seen it used that way. I'm trying to imagine, you know, people naming their capital that. But, and come up with something. Right. It was, according to Radak and Ralbag, it's a forest where the remnants of various Canaanite tribes gathered. Meaning the Jews have been defeating them. So they all get together and they build this city called Charoshet HaGoyim, the forest of these Canaanite nations. Ravbach also suggests maybe it means the place where the craftsmen of all the nations are found. Yeah, he has a couple of other ideas. But the bottom line is, this is the city that is his stronghold from which he reigns over the Jews. And to bring us right up to Devarah, Pasuk Gimel, Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. The Jews cry out to God, Kit sham me'os rechem barzelo, because he had 900 iron chariots. V'ulachatzes b'nei Yisrael b'chozka esrim shana, and he oppressed the Jews b'chozka for 20 years. Bichozka literally means with strength, but Malbim says what it means is blasphemy, meaning that he's to make fun of, not blasphemy, embarrassment. He would mock the Jews. Malbim also makes an interesting point here. If you go back to chapter 3 for a second, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tet, chapter 3, sentence 9, when we cried out to God, you see that? And then look also at chapter 3, sentence 15, when we cried out to God. What's the difference between those two? Yes. In the previous two instances, it's Vayizaku with a Zion. Here it's Vayitzaku with a Tzadi. So he says, what's the difference? Now, if you ask me what the difference was, I would say, they cried out, Zion, Tzadi can interchange, I wouldn't get hung up on it. But Malbim is never like that. Malbim wants to always see the difference. And in number 13 on your sheet, he says, Tze'aka is a greater form of crying than Ze'aka. It refers to a greater outcry. Why? Well, number one, as I translated here on the sheet, number one, he had 900 iron chariots, which was far more intimidating than what the Jews had faced earlier. Number two, he was insulting them and humiliating them. And number three, this time it's 20 years. That's longer than the previous servitudes were. I think we had 18 years and 8 years. So now they really cried out to God. So the Jews are now ready for redemption, and that is where we will then get...
Right?
Yeah, that this is worse in the sense of being under Canaan.
Right.
Yeah. So next week, God willing, we will pick up with.
I won't.
Wow.